Hi, I'm Bruce Brown. Welcome to Who Killed Custer? The Eyewitness Answer audiobook. The full version of Who Killed Custer is on Astonisher.com's 100 Voices from the Little Bighorn website, the largest and most complete collection of eyewitness accounts of the Battle of the Little Bighorn available anywhere in any form. Check it out for links to all the eyewitness accounts of the battle quoted here, exclusively on Astonisher.com. BF Communications is proud to present the eyewitness answer to the eternal question, who killed George A. Custer? Read here by the author, Bruce Brown. Part 1. Who killed Custer? You hear many names put forward as the man or woman who killed George Armstrong Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. From Sioux War Chief Rain in the Face, to Cheyenne Holy Man Yellow Nose, to Sioux Woman Warrior Moving Robe. None of these esteemed warriors actually killed Custer, though, based on the eyewitness record of the battle. To find who really killed Custer, or at least identify the most likely suspects, it is crucial to know the appearance of Custer and the other officers in his command on June 25, 1876. Boiled down, eyewitness Edward Godfrey's account of what Custer wore establishes that the strongest visual clue for Custer was his ironically named sorrel horse, Victory. There were as many as 7 officers on the field that day in buckskin, but only one on a sorrel horse with 4 white socks. Peter Thompson, the last 7th Cavalry survivor to see Custer alive, noted Custer's sorrel horse and added that Custer was wearing a broad-brimmed, cream-colored hat on his head, the brim of which was turned up on the right side and fastened by a small hook and eye to its crown. This gave him the opportunity to sight his rifle while riding. His rifle lay horizontally in front of him. Unhorsed, Custer was considerably harder to identify. Custer, the man the Sioux called Long Hair, had recently cut his hair short, and both Thompson and the Arikara scout soldier said Custer had taken off his buckskin coat and was in his shirt sleeves. Unfortunately, any number of 7th Cavalry officers could fit this general description, an officer in shirt sleeves with short hair. However, Custer's wounds may help identify his killer as well. Most observers agreed with Godfrey and 7th Cavalry surgeon Dr. H.R. Porter that Custer was shot twice, once through the ribs below the heart, and once through the left temple. It is also useful to know that unlike most of the 7th Cavalry dead, Custer was not badly mutilated. Armed with this information, we at Astonisher.com have canvassed our 100 voices, the world's largest and most complete collection of eyewitness accounts of the battles of the Little Bighorn and Rosebud, and assembled Astonisher.com's Who Killed Custer? Top 10 list. Here are the results. Stated simply, Sioux warrior White Cowbull appears to be the man who killed George Armstrong Custer. The second most likely possibility is that Custer killed himself. Either of these top 2 scenarios could be true, but White Cowbull is the prime suspect based on the eyewitness record of the battle. Part 2, and the winner is... Our number one guy, White Cowbull, doesn't just win it on points. He really does look like Custer's conqueror. Here is his story. White Cowbull, a 28-year-old Oglala Sioux warrior, said he was hanging out in the Cheyenne camp that Sunday morning with a Cheyenne buddy named Roan Bear. He, Roan Bear, was a fox warrior, belonging to one of that tribe's soldier societies, and was on guard duty that morning, White Cowbull recalled in a battlefield interview with David Humphreys Miller. He was stationed by the Shahila Cheyenne medicine teepee, in which the tribe kept their sacred buffalo head. When word of Reno's attack on the Hunk Papa end of the village swept the Cheyenne camp, White Cowbull watched Cheyenne war chief Two Moon lead his men out to meet the American attackers at a gallop. But neither he nor Roan Bear joined the departing warriors because of Roan Bear's duty to guard the sacred buffalo head. The two of them had just settled down to telling each other some of our brave deeds in the past, when another alarm ran through the camp, this time announcing that the Americans were charging to attack the village at Medicine Tail Coulee across the river from the Cheyenne camp. Happily considering themselves free to join the fight against this immediate threat, White Cowbull and Roan Bear ran to the river, where they found Bobtail Horse, White Shield, Calf, and a couple of other warriors, most without guns. On the other side of the Little Bighorn were 200-plus 7th Cavalry troopers who charged to the river's edge in hot pursuit of a handful of Indians. Alternately identified as Crazy Horse's Cheyenne decoy scouts by Sioux warrior Foolish Elk and as Five Sioux by Sioux warrior White Cowbull and George Bird Grinnell's Cheyenne informants. The Indians whipped their ponies across the ford at Medicine Tail Coulee moments ahead of the Americans. I had never seen white soldiers before, White Cowbull recalled, so I remember thinking how pink and hairy they looked. White Cowbull and the other defenders threw up a light screen of fire to cover the fleeing Indians' escape. The American soldiers halted on the opposite shore and dismounted, waiting there a few minutes until a man in a buckskin jacket shouted something and they all came charging at us across the ford. White Cowbull said, "I gave the man in the buckskin jacket my attention." Cheyenne warrior Bobtail Horse fired first, and White Cowbull saw an American soldier on a gray horse fall out of the saddle and hit the water. White Cowbull said, "The other soldiers were shooting at us now. The man who seemed to be the soldier chief was firing his heavy rifle fast. I aimed my repeater at him and fired. I saw him fall out of his saddle and hit the water." Then an amazing thing happened. White Cowbull said, as soon as the officer on the sorrel horse with four white stockings hit the water, the American charge came to an immediate and complete halt in the middle of the river. White Cowbull said that Custer's men all reined up their horses and gathered around where he had fallen. White Cowbull said he saw several American soldiers quickly dismount in the middle of the river and apparently pull the fallen officer's body out of the water. The American soldiers who jumped in the river were probably one or more of the four Custer family members with Custer when he fell, including his brothers Thomas and Boston. White Cowbull said the officer he shot in the middle of the Little Bighorn was wearing buckskin and riding a sorrel horse with four white stockings. He said the officer had a mustache and a big hat and was firing his heavy rifle fast as he led the charge across the Little Bighorn. Based on the eyewitness accounts of Custer's appearance and gear on June 25, 1876, by 7th Cavalry survivors Edward Godfrey and Peter Thompson, the man who White Cowbull shot can only be George A. Custer. Part 3. Does his story check out? Okay, but what does the eyewitness record say about White Cowbull's story? Does White Cowbull's story check out? In a word, yes. All the 13 major points of White Cowbull's story are supported by other survivors' accounts. 1. White Cowbull said Custer's men charged down Medicine Tail Coulee to the banks of the Little Bighorn. Witnessed by White Man Runs Him, Curly, Pretty Shield, Bob-Tailed Horse, White Shield, Sitting Bull, Horned Horse, He Dog, Foolish Elk, Peter Thompson, John Martin, and an anonymous 6th Infantry Sergeant. 2. White Cow Bull said three Crow scouts rode to the edge of the bluff above the river and fired down at them. Witnessed by Goes Ahead, Harry Moccasin. 3. White Cow Bull said Custer and his men were hotly pursuing a small band of Indians when they reached the river. Witnessed by Foolish Elk, George Bird Grinnell. 4. White Cow Bull said Custer and his men encountered Indian fire from the other side of the river when they reached the Little Bighorn. Witnessed by Curley, anonymous 6th Infantry Sergeant, White Shield. 5. White Cow Bull said Custer and his men paused on the far side of the river when they reached the Little Bighorn. Witnessed by Peter Thompson, White Shield. 6. White Cow Bull said after pausing, the Americans charged across the Little Bighorn River to attack the Indian village on the other side. Witnessed by Curley, Pretty Shield, Horned Horse, Elk Head, 7 anonymous hostiles. 7. White Cow Bull said the ford where Custer tried to cross the Little Bighorn was very thinly defended by the Sioux and Cheyenne. Witnessed by Bobtail Horse, White Shield, He Dog, Wooden Leg, George Bird Grinnell. 8. White Cow Bull said he was one of the few warriors there when Custer charged into the river and the Indians opened fire. Witnessed by Bobtail Horse. 9. White Cow Bull said that when the Americans tried to charge across the river at Medicine Tail Coulee, Custer rode at the head of the attack formation with the flag bearer and a small man on a dark horse, probably half Sioux interpreter scout Mitch Boyer. Witnessed by Pretty Shield. 10. White Cow Bull said a couple of 7th Cavalry troopers were shot out of the saddle and fell in the Little Bighorn before Custer's men could get across the river. Witnessed by Curley, Horned Horse, Pretty Shield, Soldier Wolf, Elkhead, Thomas LaForge, plus Sage Hollow Horn Eagle and Brave Bird reported wounded American soldiers at the river after the battle, including Mitch Boyer, the half-Sioux interpreter scout whom Pretty Shield said rode at Custer's side. 11. White Cow Bull said Custer, the officer on the sorrel horse with 4 white stockings, was one of those shot while crossing the Little Bighorn River. Witnessed by Pretty Shield. 12. White Cow Bull said Custer fell in the water of the Little Bighorn. Witnessed by Pretty Shield. 13. White Cow Bull said Custer's charge at Medicine Tail Coulee was suddenly stopped and repulsed mid-river by the Cheyenne and Sioux defenders. Witnessed by George Glenn, Curley. Taken together, there is far more eyewitness corroboration and support for White Cow Bull's story than any of the other possible Custer kill stories in the eyewitness record of the battle. So White Cow Bull's story is not only the first and best of the possible Custer kill stories, it is also the best supported. In fact, the only point of difficulty with White Cow Bull's story involves a couple of small details. E.g., both Peter Thompson and Soldier said Custer had taken off his buckskin jacket and was riding in his shirt sleeves, while White Cow Bull said the officer he shot was wearing a buckskin jacket. But who knows? Thompson and Soldier's observations were made earlier, and maybe Custer put his jacket back on for the attack. Either way, Custer was the only 7th Cavalry officer on a sorrel horse with 4 white socks. Part 4, The Runners-Up. But White Cow Bull was not the only warrior who described the death of a 7th Cavalry trooper on a sorrel horse that day. Many Sioux and Cheyenne warriors spoke of the curious suicide of an American soldier on a fast sorrel horse which was stocking-legged, in other words, a sorrel horse with four white socks, which can only be Custer's famously fast sorrel horse with four white socks, Victory. As He Dog told it, one soldier with a stocking-legged horse got away, around the big body of Indians toward the north. He had a very fast horse and was pursued until they were about to give up the chase, when he shot himself with his revolver and the horse was caught. White Cowbull added the graphic detail, "I saw him yank out his revolver and thought he was going to shoot back at these warriors. Instead, he put the revolver to his head, pulled the trigger, and fell dead." This suicide story has two important elements for identifying Custer: the crucial sorrel horse with four white socks and the fatal bullet wound to the head. Apart from White Cowbull's kill story, the Custer suicide story is the only kill story that could actually be Custer. And apart from White Cowbull's story, the Custer suicide story is also the best supported of the possible Custer kill stories in the eyewitness record of the battle. But there are two more Cheyenne kill stories involving an American officer on a sorrel horse at the end of the battle. Renowned Cheyenne warriors Brave Bear and White Shield also said they saw a 7th Cavalry officer on a sorrel horse killed near the end of the battle, and White Shield identified the killer as Northern Cheyenne warrior Old Bear with assistance from Kills in the Night. Both these kill stories are credible and check out as far as it's possible to check. Could one of these warriors be Custer's conqueror? Probably not. Here's why. Old Bear shot his victim in the back between the shoulder blades, and there is no evidence Brave Bear was carrying a gun. Furthermore, neither of these accounts mentions the slain American officer's sorrel horse having four white socks, the crucial identifying mark of Custer's horse Victory. Another problem with the American suicide and Brave Bear and Old Bear's kills is that they all came at the chaotic end of the battle. After the Americans' final defensive perimeter had collapsed, and anyone could have been riding a sorrel horse. Many Sioux, Cheyenne, and American stories of the battle, including the accounts of Gall, Lights, Mrs. Spotted Hornbull, Yellow Nose, Horned Horse, John Martin, and George Bird Grinnell, described how the Indians stampeded the 7th Cavalry's horses as the Americans retreated, producing equine mayhem on the battlefield. The same sort of problems plague all the candidates on Astonisher.com's Who Killed Custer Top 10 list, except White Cowbull. For instance, Rain in the Face's anonymous boy made his kill with a lance, not a gun. Lazy White Bull killed an officer in buckskin with short hair, but he had no mustache. Spotted Calf killed an officer with a tomahawk, not a gun, etc. But the biggest problem with the American suicide, Brave Bear, and Old Bear's claims, and all the rest on Astonisher.com's Who Killed Custer Top 10 list, is that there is no eyewitness evidence that Custer was still alive after his initial attack at Medicine Tail Coulee. In fact, the eyewitness record indicates Custer was either killed or badly wounded before any of the other warriors on Astonisher.com's Who Killed Custer Top 10 list even got into the fight against Custer's troops. Part 5. Who saw Custer last? So exactly when was Custer last seen alive? According to the eyewitness record, the last 12 men who saw Custer alive and survived the battle all encountered him just before the beginning of the Custer fight. These were the three men who carried Custer's last orders: 4 7th Cavalry stragglers and 1 Arikara and 4 Crow scouts for the 7th Cavalry. 6 of these men left eyewitness accounts that shed light on this question. Here are their final encounters with Custer, in chronological order, from first to last. Fred Golden, Fred Golden carried an unknown message penned by the regimental adjutant, Lieutenant W.W. Cook, from Custer to Reno. Golden left Custer's command before Custer and his men started their charge down Medicine Tail Coulee. Custer had just ridden with a couple of men to the edge of the bluff and grandly waved his hat. Crow Scout White Man Runs Him also described Custer waving his hat to his men below, and Medal of Honor winner Stan Roy was one of the men with Reno who saw Custer on the bluff. Upon his return, Golden heard Custer tell one of his lieutenants, "Keogh, those Indians are running. If we can keep them at it, we can afford to sacrifice half the horses in the command." Custer's men and horses were exhausted from riding all night. Custer had not yet seen the huge Indian village. Daniel Knipe carried a verbal order from Custer to Captain Thomas M. McDougall, who commanded the pack train with the 7th Cavalry's extra ammunition. "Tell McDougall to bring the pack train straight across to high ground. If the packs get loose, don't stop to fix them. Cut them off. Come quick. Big Indian camp." Knipe left Custer's command shortly after they sighted the village for the first time, which is to say, a few minutes after Golden. John Martin, or Giovanni Martini. John Martin carried the same order as Knipe, this time in writing, to Custer's best battlefield commander, Captain Frederick Benteen, moments after Knipe, perhaps because it took W.W. Cook a little longer to write it down. This is the famous, "Come on, big village, be quick" order. As with his order to McDougall, Custer stressed, Cook wrote it twice, that Benteen should bring the ammunition packs, clearly indicating that Custer expected to need a lot of ammunition. Martin left Custer's command partway down Medicine Tail Coulee, shortly after they sighted the huge village for the first time. White Man Runs Him. White Man Runs Him said that when Custer first caught glimpse of the immense Free Sioux and Cheyenne village, he declared, "These people are troublesome. I am going to teach them a lesson today." White Man Runs Him said that he and the other Crow Scouts went with Custer down the dry gulch, Medicine Tail Coulee, to near the river. According to Curley, Custer released his scouts from further service to the 7th Cavalry shortly after John Martin dashed away with Custer's last order for Benteen. Peter Thompson recalled of his first sight of the huge village in the bend of the Little Bighorn River. It was truly an imposing sight. Thompson rode with the rest of Custer's men down the Death Coulee after Golden, Knipe, Martin, and Custer's scouts departed. But before the Americans got to the river, Thompson was one of 4 7th Cavalry survivors whose horses gave out and who were, for that reason, spared. James Watson, John Fitzgerald, John Brennan, and Thompson, whose exhausted horse entirely played out near the bottom of Medicine Tail Coulee. Thus Thompson and the other 3 quickly became the sort of casualties that Custer told Keogh he was willing to accept mere minutes before. To his extreme distress, Thompson was left behind in enemy terrain as his 7th Cavalry comrades charged on to attack the huge village on the other side of the Little Bighorn River. Ironically, this dire development ultimately saved his life. After a couple of dangerously narrow escapes from the Sioux, Thompson made his way on foot to the river, where he encountered one of the 7th Cavalry's Crow Scouts in the midst of an apparent war crime, and then, for one last brief instant, Custer himself. Thompson saw Custer at the river mere minutes before Custer led the attack at Medicine Tail Coulee, an attack of 200-plus 7th Cavalry troopers that was suddenly halted and repulsed mid-river by less than a dozen warriors, as eyewitnesses White Cowbull George Glenn and Curley described. Yes, friends, that's the way the eyewitness record says it happened. This encounter with Custer, one of his Crow Scouts, and a tethered Sioux squaw on a secluded flat by the river by Thompson, who was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for valor at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, is the last positively identified sighting of Custer alive. On the Indian side, most Sioux and Cheyenne warriors, from Crazy Horse to He Dog to Standing Bear to Little Soldier, admitted the Sioux and Cheyenne did not recognize Custer during the battle, or even know that Custer was the Bluecoats' commander. Several warriors, like Foolish Elk, Left Hand, White Shield, and Lazy White Bull, saw officers in buckskin during the battle whom they later believed could have been Custer, but at the time no one knew, and those who thought they knew, like Bad Soup, actually had it wrong. Part 6, What Curley Really Said. So the whole legend of Custer heroically leading his men to the end rests on one eyewitness account, that of 19-year-old Crow Scout Curley. Although he was released from further service by Custer just before the attack, Curley shadowed the Americans to the river. By his own admission, Curley was there, watching through binoculars, when Custer tried to charge across the Little Bighorn at Medicine Tail Coulee. No more than a few minutes after Thompson saw Custer and an unnamed Crow scout, probably Curley, with a tethered Sioux squaw on the riverbank just upstream from Medicine Tail Coulee. Asked when Custer was killed, Curley stated in his first account of the battle, published in the Helena Daily Herald on July 15, 1876, Custer remained alive through the greater part of the engagement, animating his men to determined resistance, but about an hour before the close of the fight received a mortal wound. That's it. That's the rock on which American Little Bighorn scholars have built the whole heroic legend that was first depicted in the stirring etching by A.K. Wad that appeared in Harper's in the fall of 1876 and later codified in American heroic iconography by the Otto Becker lithograph Custer's Last Fight that was widely distributed to American saloons and taverns a quarter century after the battle as a promotional gimmick by the Anheuser-Busch Brewing Company. Not much of a rock, especially when you consider that Curley admitted he was quite sensibly hiding in a deep ravine for most of the Custer fight, where he could see little of the battle, let alone whether Custer was leading his men or not at the end. Curley was frank about this. He told the Helena Daily Herald he was not well informed about most of the battle. In fact, the only portion of the battle that Curley personally witnessed was at the river at the very beginning of the Custer fight, when he saw two 7th Cavalry troopers blown out of the saddle as they tried to charge across the Little Bighorn. That's also when Curley said Custer was shot. In the same breath, the same sentence actually, where he told the Americans what they so badly wanted to hear, that Custer remained alive through the greater part of the engagement, Curley also slipped the Americans the cold, hard truth, that Custer was mortally wounded an hour before the end of the fight. Curley didn't estimate the total length of the Custer fight, and there is disagreement in the eyewitness record on this point, but witnesses on both sides, such as Sioux warriors He Dog, Lazy White Bull, Flying Hawk, and American scout George Herendeen, agreed that the second portion of the battle, the Custer fight, lasted about an hour. If that's true, Curley wasn't saying that Custer was killed at the end on Last Stand Hill at all, but rather the opposite. What Curley was actually saying was that Custer died at the outset of the Custer fight, about the time Curley saw a couple of Custer's men get shot out of the saddle charging across the Little Bighorn, and White Cowbull shot an officer on a sorrel horse with four white stockings in the middle of the river. This is also when Pretty Shield said Custer died in the waters of the Little Bighorn. And Gall and Crazy Horse agreed. Although they didn't know the specifics of Custer's death, both Crazy Horse and Gall, the powerful Oglala and Hunk Papa Sioux war chiefs who were hammer and anvil for the 7th Cavalry that day in June 1876, judged from the way the battle unfolded that Custer was killed early in the Custer fight. Gall said, "Custer personally and those with him were probably the very first ones to fall in the day." And Crazy Horse said, "We disposed of the leaders in a very short time, and if he, Custer, was unfortunate enough to be one of the group in the lead, he was one of the first to fall." Minneconjou Sioux warrior Hump struck a similar note in 1881 when he recalled that Custer's men seemed confused, i.e. leaderless, from the time the Indians counterattacked at Medicine Tail Coulee, i.e. from near the beginning of the Custer fight. Horned Horse and Curly agreed. Horned Horse described how Custer's men reeled back toward the bluffs after losing several men who tumbled into the water. And Curly, who watched the start of the Custer fight from a safe distance, said that Custer's men fought poorly from the beginning. Curly said it looked like Custer's men did not know anything much about fighting, something that could not be said of troops actively commanded by George A. Custer. Part 7. Where was Custer? When you listen to White Cowbull and Curly and Pretty Shield and Gall and Crazy Horse and Hump and Horned Horse and Peter Thompson and George Glenn, the Battle of the Little Bighorn suddenly makes sense. Consider what happened next. Right after White Cowbull said he shot an officer on a sorrel horse with four white stockings, and Pretty Shield said Custer fell in the water. As quickly and completely as if you'd thrown a switch, Custer disappeared from all further eyewitness accounts of the battle, and his men simultaneously lost all strategic direction. Custer's men continued to show some tactical capacity for a while longer, e.g. their charge to drive back the Indians gathering lower down on Calhoun Ridge, as Wooden Leg and Foolish Elk described, but there is no further evidence of any strategy on their part, or any will to press the offensive Custer had thrown his men into so enthusiastically mere minutes before. Nor did Custer's men do what the circumstances desperately demanded, which was to reunite with troops under Marcus Reno and or Frederick Benteen. History demonstrates this was their only chance for survival. But after the charge at Medicine Tail Coulee was thrown back, Custer's men didn't continue the attack, and they didn't maneuver for reinforcement either. Custer's men simply presented themselves on the doorstep of the largest Plains Indian village in recorded history, fired two signal volleys so everyone within 10 miles knew exactly where they were, and then obligingly waited as Cheyenne warriors Soldier Wolf, Brave Wolf, and Tall Bull recounted for the Indians to gather enough force to drive them like a nail. Strong circumstantial evidence that Custer was still alive at this point, but so badly wounded that his men feared he would die if they moved him. The accounts of 7th Cavalry survivors with Reno and Benteen clearly indicate that they expected support from Custer, support which never came. Medal of Honor winner Charles Windolf expressed it bluntly when he asked, "Where was Custer?" Windolf concluded, "All we knew was that he had disappeared with half the regiment." William Slaper added, "I was, however, considerably worried about where Custer was and why he had failed to support us as he had promised to do." In fact, Custer's men continued to believe that Custer was going to ride to their rescue through the night of June 25, 26. When Reno ordered his men to entrench that night, the response was lackluster because They doubtless expected that General Custer would make his appearance during the night and our labor would be wasted, recalled William O. Taylor. And John Ryan remembered, about the middle of the night we heard a trumpet call, and the men commenced to cheer, thinking it was Custer's men who were coming to our assistance. Major Reno ordered one of our trumpeters to sound a call, but it was not repeated, so we made up our minds that it was a decoy on the part of the Indians. William O. Taylor and Peter Thompson also described the same scene with the Indian trumpeter. Custer loyalist John Berkman overheard Reno's bitter comments about Custer that same night, and 7th Cavalry surgeon Dr. Henry Porter recalled how during the 2 days we were surrounded by the Indians, the inquiry among our men for Custer was loud, and that general's court-martial was freely speculated upon. Custer's surviving men couldn't understand why their commander hadn't supported them and the attack he ordered. Although they had no idea what had befallen Custer, his men knew there was something deeply wrong in Custer's behavior, and they were right. If Custer was still compos mentis and commanding his men, it is impossible to imagine him meekly allowing a handful of defenders to both thwart his attack on the village and prevent him from taking any further action to support or reinforce Reno and his men. This is especially true since Custer already knew from 4 of his scouts, Harry Moccasin goes ahead, White Man runs him and Fred Girard, that the 112 7th Cavalry troopers he sent with Reno badly needed his support. Part 8, 112 men. These were 112 of Custer's men. 112 men Custer had ordered to charge the huge Sioux and Cheyenne village on the Little Bighorn River, an encampment White Man Runs Him called the biggest Indian camp I have ever seen. From the intelligence he had received before the battle, Custer knew that Reno and his men were outnumbered by at least 10 to 1, and possibly by as much as 15 to 1. Without the support he had promised them, Custer knew these men were on a suicide mission. White Man Runs Him, Standing Bear, Horned Horse, and Mrs. Spotted Hornbull all agreed that Custer allowed what seemed like a long interval of time to pass between Reno's charge and his own attack on the village, possible evidence of Custer's ruthless glory-seeking, or perhaps simply his inability to find a suitable place to cross the river. By the time Custer led the charge down Medicine Tail Coulee, the time for waiting was over. The battle was raging, and Custer knew from his scouts that Reno's men were literally getting annihilated. He had asked these 112 men to bleed for him. Now they were bleeding, and they badly needed the support he had promised them. At this point, it was imperative for Custer to immediately support his men, either by diversionary attack or direct reinforcement. As every observer, Frederick Benteen, Marcus Reno, William Edgerly, William Slaper, the findings of the Marcus Reno Court of Inquiry, etc., agreed, Custer said he would. Custer's number 2 in command, Marcus Reno, recalled how he received his orders from Custer just before the beginning of the battle. I was given the command of companies M, A, and G, Reno said, and was ordered by General Custer to proceed at as rapid a gait as I thought prudent, and afterward to charge, and that I would be supported by the whole outfit. This order was brought to me by Colonel Cook, adjutant of the regiment. After Colonel Cook gave me these instructions, he rode with me for some time, as also Captain Keogh, and said, in his laughing, smiling way, "We are all going with the advance, and Miles Keogh is coming too." Instead, Keogh's body was found where he fell during the retreat from Medicine Tail Coulee, in a heap with the corpses of nearly 40 of his men, while Cook fell further up the hill, where Cheyenne lawyer Wooden Leg scalped one of his long mutton chop whiskers. So what happened? Custer's attack at Medicine Tail Coulee was the sort of battlefield moment that Custer lived for, when everything was on the line and there was great glory there to be won. Why didn't Custer continue his attack at Medicine Tail Coulee when he had the element of surprise and a virtually undefended ford in front of him? Or alternately, why didn't Custer maneuver to join forces with Reno and directly reinforce his beleaguered command when Custer knew from four of his scouts that Reno and his men were in big trouble? This is the central enigma of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Why did Custer apparently freeze at the crucial moment in the battle? Did Custer lose his nerve? Or perhaps his mind? The eyewitness account of Billy Jackson, as told by James Watson to Peter Thompson, suggests that Custer may have possibly lost it at the end, but there is no hint of cowardice in the eyewitness record of Custer. Part 9. Custer did not freeze. Whatever else you want to say about George Armstrong Custer, he was not a man to freeze at the crucial moment of a battle, and the eyewitness record makes it clear that Custer did not freeze at the Little Bighorn. John Martin, who carried Custer's last order to Benteen, recalled that just before the charge at Medicine Tail Coulee, Custer told his men what he planned to do, stating confidently, "We will go down and make a crossing and capture the village." Three of Custer's Crow scouts, White Man Runs Him, Goes Ahead, and Curly, testified that Custer did what he said, leading his men down Medicine Tail Coulee to attack the Indian village on the other side of the Little Bighorn River. Curly said that when the Indian village came in sight, Custer appeared very much elated and ordered the bugles to sound a charge. 7th Cavalry Trooper Peter Thompson also described how he and the rest of Custer's command began to charge on sight of the village. Daniel Kanipe recalled, "The men were on the hill. We all gave them three cheers, riding at a full gallop. Some of them couldn't hold their horses, galloping past General Custer. He shouted at them, 'Boys, hold your horses. There are plenty of them down there for us all.'" Brule Sioux warrior Foolish Elk, who was sitting in front of his lodge across the river in the Indian village, caught sight of the American soldiers at the same moment. He remembered, "A trumpet blared and they began to gallop." While Hunk Papa Sioux observer Mrs. Spotted Hornbull, also called Pretty White Buffalo Woman, remembered the music of the bugle as Custer's men rode down to the river where the attack was to be made. Excused from further service by Custer, the Crow scouts parted company with the American soldiers just after Martin departed with Custer's last order for Benteen. But all four continued down to the river independently, bent on their own dark business. From the banks of the Little Bighorn, and subsequently from the bluffs above while they were fleeing for their lives, the four Crow scouts caught some of the last living glimpses of Custer's doomed command. Here are their primary memories. White Man Runs Him said, "Custer tried to cross the river, but was unable to do so. This was the last time we saw Custer." Curly, who was not with the other three, said much the same thing. They, the Sioux, would not let the soldiers cross the river, Curley recalled in 1916. When Custer tried to charge across the Little Bighorn, Curley saw two of Custer's men killed who fell in the stream. A short time later, before the Indians had marshaled enough strength to cross the river and drive the Americans back, Goes Ahead heard Custer's men fire two volleys. Part 10 at Medicine Tail Coulee. Unfortunately, confusion has long clung to Custer's attack at Medicine Tail Coulee, due largely to statements by people who were not actually eyewitnesses to the action there. For instance, on the 10th anniversary of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, Hunk Papa War Chief Gall essentially said that the second Custer fight portion of the battle didn't begin until he got there, and flatly denied that Custer ever charged to the river at Medicine Tail Coulee. As important as Gall was to the Indian cause that day, he was wrong on this point, as the overwhelming eyewitness evidence demonstrates. In fact, Gall didn't know what happened at Medicine Tail Coulee because he wasn't there at the crucial moment when Custer led the 7th Cavalry's charge across the Little Bighorn. Almost no one was there, except some fleeing women and a handful of warriors, mostly Cheyennes, Bobtail Horse, White Shield, Roan Bear, Mad Wolf, and Calf. Oglala Sioux marksman White Cowbull was the lone Sioux present at the beginning. The only Hunk Papa observer was Mrs. Spotted Hornbull, who described Custer's charge down Medicine Tail Coulee, but did not see what happened at the river. None of the Hunk Papas saw what happened at Medicine Tail Coulee. Why? Because Reno's surprise attack hit the Hunk Papa portion of the village first, murdering women and children. The Hunk Papas were fiercely focused on the Reno fight. Crow King, Gall, Rain in the Face, and Hawkman were among the Hunk Papa war chiefs who figured prominently in the early fighting, which halted Reno's advance and forced the first American retreat. When Custer led the charge at Medicine Tail Coulee, Gall was still miles away fighting the troops under Reno, who had murdered his family. According to an 1883 account by Mrs. Spotted Hornbull, Gall didn't get into the Custer fight until after Custer's men had been driven back from the river. However, the 7th Cavalry's Four Crow Scouts were there at Medicine Tail Coulee at that crucial moment, and in a 1919 battlefield interview with General H.L. Scott, White Man Runs Him declared emphatically, "I know for sure that Custer went right to the riverbank. I saw him go that far. The Sioux were right across the river." White Cowbull was one of the Sioux who were right across the river at that moment, and he said the same thing. White Cowbull also said the American soldiers paused briefly at the river, just as Marcus Reno had done with his men before attacking the other end of the village, and White Shield and Peter Thompson agreed. White Shield described how, when Custer's men got pretty close to the river, they dismounted, and all the soldiers back as far as I could see stopped and dismounted also. Then, moments before the attack, Thompson saw Custer riding along the banks of the Little Bighorn, personally scouting for a better place to cross the river, a peculiar but well-documented habit of Custer's. Crow Scout Curley said the problem with crossing at the ford at Medicine Tail Coulee was it could only be done in columns of fours, meaning the American soldiers had to ride in relatively tight formation, which made them more vulnerable to enemy fire. A dead-on observation, as it turned out. Sioux warrior Horned Horse also said there was a problem with quicksand at the Medicine Tail Coulee ford. Part 11, War Crime Time. It was at this moment, when the 7th Cavalry had charged down Medicine Tail Coulee to the banks of the Little Bighorn and dismounted, that Custer left his command and rode alone, a little less than 1,000 feet, up the Little Bighorn River. Because the Little Bighorn was bounded on one side by steep bluffs and on the other by thicket and the huge free Sioux and Cheyenne village, Custer actually rode in the riverbed much of the way, meaning he left no trail until he clambered out of the water on the first flat. And it was there, On the first flat along the Little Bighorn above the ford at Medicine Tail Coulee, that Custer was last seen alive. 2 7th Cavalry stragglers, Peter Thompson and James Watson, encountered Custer there moments before the 7th Cavalry's attack at Medicine Tail Coulee. Thompson said almost as soon as he and Watson followed a highly eroded trail to the river, they more or less simultaneously stumbled on Custer and one of Custer's Crow scouts in the midst of an apparent war crime with a tethered Sioux squaw. Custer's troops had begun the Battle of the Little Bighorn much as Custer had begun the Washita Massacre 8 years before, with an unprovoked sucker-punch attack, murdering women and children, starting with the Sioux boy Deeds, shooting at One Bull, the man Sitting Bull deputized to ask for parley with the American attackers, and setting fire to the village. But here, on the banks of the Little Bighorn, in the last few minutes of his life, Custer apparently acquitted himself with honor. According to Thompson, Custer rode straight to the Crow Scout, probably Curly, who was alone at the river at that exact moment, and commenced to talk to him by sign language, whereupon the scout released the Sioux woman he had roped. Thompson recalled that she, the tethered squaw, seemed glad to be free, and came running towards us in a half-stooping posture, and in her hand was a long-bladed knife of ugly dimensions. So fierce did she look that my hand involuntarily sought the handle of my revolver. Then Custer motioned to Thompson and his companion James Watson to follow him and rode quickly back along the river bank the way he came. Thompson and Watson were on foot, though, so fortunately, as it turned out for them, they couldn't keep up with Custer, who spurred victory back to his 200-plus men waiting at the ford downriver and defeat. White Cowbull saw Custer across the river when he returned from this quick scout, although he didn't know who the American soldier chief was. White Cowbull said, "The man in the buckskin jacket seemed to be the leader of these soldiers, for he shouted something, and they all came charging at us across the ford." From the eyewitness accounts of Cheyenne warriors White Shield and Bobtailed Horse, as well as Sioux warriors White Cowbull and He Dog, and Cheyenne chronicler George Bird Grinnell, we know that the ford where Custer tried to cross the Little Bighorn was very thinly defended, as Custer likely hoped and anticipated. So how could less than a dozen warriors, many like White Shield without a gun, turn back the charge of more than 200 7th Cavalry troopers with Custer in the lead? Part 12. Custer died in the water. Well, based on the eyewitness record of the battle, the answer is easy. Before the vanguard of the charge got across the river, Custer took a slug in the ribs below the heart from the repeating rifle of Oglala Sioux marksman White Cowbull and toppled from his saddle into the river, either dead or so badly wounded that he was not a factor for the remainder of the battle. This is not the heroic Custer story that the Americans like to tell themselves, the one full of buckskin bravado to the bitter end. But a few of the Indians, supported by a few 7th Cavalry survivors, have been trying to tell a different story from the beginning. In his first eyewitness account of the battle, Curly said he saw two of Custer's men killed who fell into the stream. Describing the same moment in the battle, White Cowbull, who was much closer to the action than the furtive Curly, said the second trooper shot mid-river was an officer on a sorrel horse with four white stockings. In other words, Custer himself, although White Cowbull didn't know that at the time. Crow chronicler Pretty Shield, who gave the Crow Scouts' candid four-family version of what happened that day, told the same story from the 7th Cavalry side. She said both Goes Ahead, her husband, and Half Yellow Face, her uncle, the leader of the 7th Cavalry's Crow Scouts, told her that Custer was shot at the outset of the battle, not the end, and died in the waters of the Little Bighorn. White Cow Bull said the 7th Cavalry's charge stopped the moment the officer on the sorrel horse was blown out of the saddle and hit the water, whereupon the American troopers all reined in their horses and gathered around where he had fallen, exactly the sort of rudderless behavior that characterized Custer's men for the last hour of their lives. According to 7th Cavalry survivor George Glenn, the physical evidence the day after the battle supported what White Cow Bull said. Glenn, who went over the battlefield on burial detail, said, "We found the trail of Custer's charge going down in the river, but it seems Custer got repulsed before he got across the river because we never found any trail of him on the other side of the river." White Cow Bull said two American soldiers besides Custer were shot out of the saddle and fell in the waters of the Little Bighorn, while Curley said he saw two of Custer's men killed who fell in the stream. Cheyenne warrior Soldier Wolf said two soldiers were killed and left there, and Sioux War Chief Horned Horse spoke of Custer losing several men who tumbled into the water. Pretty Shield agreed, naming one of the dead as Mitch Boyer, Custer's half-Sioux interpreter for the Crow Scouts. White Cow Bull said he saw a small man on a dark horse, who was probably Boyer, riding beside the officer on a sorrel horse with four white stockings, but White Cow Bull did not see him shot. Both 7th Cavalry Scout Thomas LaForge and Arapaho Warrior Sage, or well-knowing one, told a story that seems to fit like a piece in a jigsaw puzzle with the story told by White Cow Bull and Pretty Shield. Essentially, Sage and LaForge said Boyer was badly wounded at the river but did not die. And LaForge added that Boyer was shot in the back, which could explain why White Cow Bull didn't see it. It happened after gunsmoke had obscured the river and Custer's men were pulling back to the far shore. LaForge said Sage and Boyer subsequently struggled to the edge of the river at Medicine Tail Coulee, where he was discovered by the Sioux after the battle. Boyer begged to be killed and was accommodated, after which the Sioux threw his body into the river. Sage spoke of two wounded Americans found at the edge of the river who were killed by the Indians, Boyer and a soldier with a bugle and a carbine. Curley also identified one of the Americans killed at the river as the bugler, adding that the bugler was the only American who actually got across the river into the Cheyenne camp. Brule Sioux warriors Hollow Horn Eagle and Brave Bird told a story about the bugler which seems to provide another piece of the puzzle. As with Boyer, they said the bugler was badly wounded but not dead when he was found after the battle by Woman Who Walks with the Stars, wife of Brule Chief Crow Dog. It was Woman Who Walks with the Stars who finally killed the bugler, probably Henry Voss. According to Reno's official report on the burial of the dead, dated July 5, 1876, the Americans never found Boyer's body. But LaForge, who was an eyewitness to the condition of the battlefield immediately afterwards, noted that Boyer's vest, made of the skin of a spotted calf, was found near the river after the battle. And according to George Glenn, the 7th Cavalry burial detail found the body nearest the river was that of the chief trumpeter, Henry Voss. August Devoto, another 7th Cavalry survivor who was also on burial detail, recalled they found Voss all alone and stark naked. His body was in a kneeling position and his back stuck full of arrows. Part 13, After Custer Fell. Everyone who could flee was fleeing now. The Crow Scouts were whipping their horses for the horizon, and Custer's Arikara Scout, Black Fox, was already long gone. It was at this point, after Custer's men had retreated back to the far side of the Little Bighorn, but before the Indians were able to cross the river and drive them back up the hill, that Crow Scout Goes Ahead saw and heard Custer's troops fire two controlled volleys. Two volleys were also heard by some of the troopers fighting for their lives with Reno a couple of miles away, including John Berkman and Edward Godfrey, both of whom later believed the double volley was intended as a distress signal or a location indicator. Peter Thompson, who was hiding in an oxbow just upriver from the mouth of Medicine Tail Coulee, also apparently caught a glimpse of Custer's men shortly after Custer fell. He saw Custer's troops on the banks of the Little Bighorn across from the village, drawn up in battle line, two men deep. After some light skirmishing at the ford where Custer fell, a rapidly growing Indian force commanded by Cheyenne war chiefs Contrary Big Belly, Yellow Nose, Lame White Man, and Comes in Sight, the latter the brother of the renowned Cheyenne woman warrior, Buffalo Calf Road Woman, crossed the river and drove Custer's decapitated command back in disarray. Minneconjou Sioux warrior Hump recalled in 1881 that Custer's men seemed confused, and Oglala Sioux war chief Horned Horse painted a similar picture. Horned Horse, who was a lieutenant and spokesman for Crazy Horse, said he, Custer, made a dash to get across the Little Bighorn, but the head of his command reeled back toward the bluffs after losing several men who tumbled into the water. You can get an idea of how rattled the Americans were at this moment from the fact that they abandoned the body of New York Herald correspondent Mark Kellogg, a stone's throw from the Little Bighorn. But Cheyenne warrior Hanging Wolf also saw them rescue a trooper whose horse had been shot and carry him with them as they retreated. When John Martin, who was carrying Custer's last order, the famous Big Village, Be Quick, Bring Packs message, looked back at his comrades for the last time from high ground, he saw Custer's command over on the flat and Indians over in the village riding toward the river and waving buffalo hides to stampede the Americans' horses. The battalion appeared to be falling back from the river. Peter Thompson also got a look at Custer's men for the last time when they were retreating up Calhoun Ridge under heavy attack from the Indians, who were by then deploying a sort of living Gatling gun against the Americans, one of several clever Indian battlefield tactics at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. It was at this point that Rain in the Face's Anonymous Youth and Spotted Calf made their kills, which are number 5 and 6, respectively, on Astonisher.com's Who Killed Custer Top 10 list. Apart from timing, the problem with the stories of the Anonymous Youth and Spotted Calf is that neither of them was carrying a gun, and Custer died of gunshot wounds. All the other possible Custer kills on Astonisher.com's Who Killed Custer Top 10 list, actually numbers 7 through 18, occurred after this in the Mayhem at the End. Part 14 of Whirlwind. Meanwhile, news of Custer's attack on the Cheyenne end of the village ran like a whirlwind through the Sioux and Cheyenne warriors who were by then besieging Reno in the bluffs across the river between 2 and 3 miles away. Large numbers of them, including warriors commanded by Sioux war chiefs Sitting Bull, Crow King Gall, and Runs the Enemy, hastily turned to confront Custer's men, who were by then retreating from the Cheyenne along the ridge above the river, while Sioux War Chief Crazy Horse rode with a joint Sioux and Cheyenne force to flank the Americans, repeating his devastating flanking move against Reno, which broke the Americans' line in the timber and began the killing rout in the Reno fight only a few minutes before. A vengeful Gaul, who led a strong contingent of Hunk Papa Sioux, recalled in 1886, the Indians were in coulees behind and in front of Custer as he moved up the ridge to take position and were just as many as the grass. Reporting of the quick afternoon sortie led by Captain Thomas Weir of Reno's Company M to try to discover what happened to Custer, 7th Cavalry survivor Edward Pigford said, "The appearance of Indians coming from Custer Ridge towards Weir Hills looked as thick as grasshoppers in a harvest field." The Helena Daily Herald wrote, "Curley says the firing was more rapid than anything he had ever conceived of, being a continuous roll, like, as he expressed it, the snapping of threads in the tearing of a blanket." Peter Thompson also described the incredible din as the battle ignited to full fury and the Sioux and Cheyenne squaws began wailing for loved ones lost. The noise gradually became louder and louder until it became indescribable and almost unbearable to the ears of civilized persons, recalled Thompson. Among the free Sioux, many spoke of the battle clamor, too. Blackfoot Sioux War Chief Kill Eagle said the noise of the battle was simply terrific, and at its height, Minneconjou Sioux warrior Standing Bear said the sounds of the gunshots, Curley's snapping of the threads and the tearing of a blanket, all merged into one unified, all-consuming roar. "There were so many guns going off that I couldn't hear them," remembered Standing Bear. In the early going, many of Custer's men fought coolly and courageously until they were overwhelmed and killed. Gall, who was an eyewitness to the action on Calhoun Ridge, said Lieutenant James Calhoun's men died fighting as skirmishers, while Keogh rallied his company, which was all killed in a bunch. The corpses of Captain Miles Keogh and nearly 40 of his men were found in a heap after the battle. White Cowbull remembered, "It was a day of bravery, even for our soldier enemies, who fought well and died in courage," while Cheyenne warrior Soldier Wolf recalled, "Custer's men fought well and bravely," and even Sioux War Chief Sitting Bull said of the hated American invaders, "They were brave men." However, many Sioux and Cheyenne warriors also described the 7th Cavalry troopers they faced as cowardly, drunk, and confused, or what Sioux warriors Lights and Hollow Hornbear termed demoralized. And Sitting Bull, when he was done making statesmanlike pronouncements, compared Custer's soldiers to quaking aspen, saying with typically deadpan Indian wit, "These were the Longhair's soldiers." The eyewitness record also clearly demonstrates another aspect of the battle that Americans have preferred to ignore for over a century. The fact that many of the American soldiers at the Little Bighorn committed suicide. In addition to the curious suicide of the lone American who could be Custer on the fast horse at the end, described by He Dog, White Cowbull, Wooden Leg, and Foolish Elk, group suicides by American soldiers were described by the Sioux and the Cheyenne, including Wooden Leg, Turning Hawk, Turtle Rib, Kate Bighead, Black Wolf, Pine, Limpy, Bobtail Horse, Rising Sun, Red Fox, and Diving Backward. Rain in the Face said other American soldiers got on their knees and begged in vain for their lives, recalling eyewitness Henry Lemley's tale of how an American soldier handed his gun to the nearest Sioux warrior at the Battle of the Rosebud and was promptly killed with it. This breakdown of command and tactical cohesion among the Americans further demonstrates that Custer was no longer animating his men to determined resistance, as Curley put it. The desperate men in Custer's rudderless command may have spent that last hour of their lives waiting for steely Frederick Benteen, whom Custer had summoned in his last order. Or they may have simply had no idea what to do with the mortal mess that Custer had gotten them into. Either way, Benteen was never coming. While responding to Custer's last order, Benteen had run into Reno's badly mauled troops and stopped to provide them the support Custer had promised, but never delivered to the point men on the American attack. Describing how he found Reno, Benteen wrote to his wife 10 days after the battle, "I saw an immense number of Indians on the plain, mounted, of course, and charging down on some dismounted men of Reno's command. The balance of Reno's command were mounted and flying for dear life to the bluffs on the same side of the river that I was. I then marched my 3 companies down to them, and a more delighted lot of folks you never saw." White Man Runs Him believed that Benteen saved the lives of Reno and his men. If those soldiers, Reno's men, hadn't turned back and been reinforced by the pack train, they would have all been killed. The Sioux were coming up fast. However, by the time Benteen and Reno secured their defense and sent out a sortie to look for Custer, it was too late for the 212 men in Custer's command. So instead of Benteen, Custer's men got Lame White Man and Brave Bear and Yellow Nose and Two Moon and Wooden Leg and Gall and Crow King and Rain in the Face and Red Horse and American Horse and Moving Robe and Low Dog and He Dog and Hump and Charging Hawk and Little Hawk and Flying Hawk and Waterman and Short Bull and Lazy White Bull and One Bull and White Cow Bull. And the greatest of the 19th century Native American Mujahideen, Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, all with splendid Indian command and no help at all from the prostrate form of George A. Custer, which his men carried with them like a proverbial dead weight until nearly the end. Part 15, Custer's Men, All Alone at the End. When you break it down, there are 2 very different stories of what happened at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. One of them, the accepted consensus view taught to virtually every American child for over a century, has Custer dying at the end on Last Stand Hill. Unfortunately, as discussed above, there is no eyewitness support for this theory at all. It therefore rests entirely on the circumstantial evidence of where Custer's corpse was found, which is meaningless under the circumstances. As the eyewitness accounts of 7th Cavalry Surgeon Dr. H.R. Porter, Peter Thompson, Edward Pigford, and William O. Taylor vividly indicate, the Americans were terrified of falling into the hands of the savages, realistically fearing they would be tortured in life and mutilated in death. 7th Cavalry troopers were willing to risk their lives to prevent dead and dying comrades from falling into Indian hands, as the case of Private James J. Tanner on the night of June 25th illustrates. There is no doubt that Custer's retreating men would have carried their fallen leader with them, dead or alive, especially since 4 of Custer's family were with him when he fell, his brothers Thomas Custer and Boston Custer, his nephew Henry Armstrong Reed, and his brother-in-law Thomas Calhoun. You can gauge the strength of the American impulse to carry Custer's body from the fact that William O. Taylor thought they should have continued to carry it back to Fort Lincoln. There was plenty of salt, he said. Fact is, the accepted consensus view of the Battle of the Little Bighorn is simply unable to explain many important aspects of the battle, such as why Custer abandoned his attack at Medicine Tail Coulee in the middle of the river, why Custer didn't directly reinforce Reno, how and when Custer was killed, why Custer's men fired two apparent signal volleys at the very beginning of the Custer fight before they were under heavy pressure from the Indians, what happened to Curley, etc. In short, the accepted consensus view of the Battle of the Little Bighorn is riddled with Ptolemaic problems and simply does not square with the facts of the battle from the eyewitness record. The eyewitness record says Custer was killed at the beginning of the Custer fight when Custer did what he told his men he intended to do, which is to say, charge across the ford at Medicine Tail Coulee and attack the huge village on the other side of the Little Bighorn. Nor are the problems with the accepted consensus view of the Battle of the Little Bighorn restricted to Custer. The story the Americans teach their children also makes a shameful hash of the 7th Cavalry's Indian Scout story. See the twisted saga of the 7th Cavalry's Unsung Scouts for more info. Then there's the other explanation for the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the eyewitness explanation. White Cowbull's account of shooting an officer on a sorrel horse with four white stockings, who can only be Custer, at the beginning of the battle is supported in its various parts by nearly two dozen other eyewitness accounts from Sioux, Cheyenne, Arapaho, Crow, and American survivors of the battle. It also makes sense and simultaneously resolves most of the persistent problems with the accepted consensus view cited above. So it turns out that the eyewitness record of the Battle of the Little Bighorn reveals that the cherished American picture of Custer standing heroically erect in buckskin at the end is a lie, as Pretty Shield put it. The sort of big, heroic, self-serving lie that Americans love to tell themselves. Then, during America's illegal, immoral, atrocity-laced invasion of the Great Sioux Nation, and now, during America's illegal, immoral, atrocity-laced invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq.